Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction and free shipping. And that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Calling Tao City, turn on your radio. I know we had some words last time, but that was so long ago. I got your message. It was a little harsh, you know. It's still a little hard for me to hear. Please take it slow.
Welcome to Starship Sofa, part of the District of Wonders network. Everyone has a story in the District of Wonders. Come and find yours.
I'm tuning in to your transmissions. I'm rooting, waiting to be found. And I'm building rockets. I'm pointing them to the moon.
This is the Starship Sova. Everybody, welcome. Hello and welcome to show 731. I am your host, Tony C. Smith. Hello, everyone. I hope everyone is fine and dandy. Well, we have some exciting news today to tell you. Yes, indeed. I'll tell you what's coming in today's show. It is the main fiction, and it is Edward M. Lena with his short story, Nothing to Lose, which actually first appeared in the fantastic Galaxy Edge magazine, May 2017. Yes, that's all coming in today's show. But first, we have a big announcement. Yes, Sofa Notes podcast is launched. Yes, this is my very new podcast, along with my good friend Brian Alexander. We are talking science fiction books, TV shows, films, all linking with today's technology. So, I mean, and the race is on at the moment with the technology. It's just leaps and bounds. So it is out now. We have done two as like a soft launch. So there's links in the show notes there. What I'm going to do now is play you a little bit from that show.
Ready to rock?
Born ready to rock.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Sofa Notes. Yes, joined by myself and my good friend, Brian Alexander. Brian, how are you doing, sir?
Greetings from the East Coast of the United States.
Lots to talk about today, Brian. Science fiction, fact, everything. Jumping down. Do you know what it is, Brian? It gets us excited when I kind of build up the show notes and you're adding in the show notes. You think, oh, good show, and definitely got a good show today. So the run-through is we're going to talk about a few little things, some news, what's been in the news and everything like that. Then maybe a couple of science fiction TV programs. There's a lot happening in that space at the moment. Then don't forget, there is like a private feed. That would be fantastic if you joined that. £5 a month or $5 a month, which will get you, today we're going to talk about, this will be for the private feed, Severance, it's the Apple TV program Severance, the science fiction one, which I just want another series of that. Bring it back as quick as possible, please, please. I'm waiting too long for it. So that will be our little private section, but like little to help with, you know, do this show, a little reward there. But that's later, that's important. But everything in the show notes as well, so you can check them out. Brian, are you good?
I'm great. I have lots to talk about.
Oh, excellent. Well, We'll kick off, Brian, and because I should have asked you this the last week, do you know what I mean? But yous a couple of weeks ago had a solar eclipse, and I never even thought to mention this, you know what I mean? Because it ties in exactly, because I typed in the chat GPT, you know, what solar eclipse? Is there any science fiction? And I should have known, to be honest. You know, Nightfall by the man himself, Asimov.
Yes.
You know what I mean? 1941. Yes. And I can't remember how old he was when he wrote it, Brian.
Maybe about 12, maybe 13.
Something ridiculous like that. You know, it was one of his kind of early stuff. But it's amazing that, like, at such a young age, to write that such a powerful story and for it to still have legs years later. You know, and I even, Brian, when I kind of realized, I thought, right, I'll this time I'll mention, you know, the eclipse. On Audible, you can buy X-1 version of it, and it was like something like 59 pence. Do you know what I mean? Like half a dollar. Nice. And just, it holds up still to this day. Do you know what I mean? So, you know what I really like found interesting? What, you know, like not clever writing, but just very good writing as this Nightfall, this claustrophobic feeling that he got from his words, Asimov, you know what I mean? That just from like a young lad writing stories at that age, like 1941. Mm. This X-1 was a great production. Do you know what I mean?
Well, it was a great show, X-1. Mm. Well, I mean, I still love there's so much in the story that's great, but especially that he ramps it up at the end when the stars come out. But it's not just an ordinary star field, right? It's at the center of a globular cluster, right? So the stars are everywhere. I mean, it's it's an extraordinary story. Should I tell you about what we did here in North America for the eclipse?
All right. Yes, please.
Well, my wife and I drove up to Detroit because my brother-in-law was getting married on the day of the eclipse, which says something. I'm not sure what. But we went up on top of a roof. We had our eclipse glasses on. It was a bright, sunny day, blue skies. And then the eclipse glasses are tremendous because they basically shut out everything. Everything is black except for the sun. And it almost looks like an infographic when you see it. And the sun is a perfect circle. And then it just got nibbled away bit by bit. And then, you know, it looked just like a drawing. And I was trying to take photos of it, which was tricky. My camera had to keep changing its focal length and going back and forth. And I got some good ones. But once it got to the majority of the sun being blocked out, that's when the world started to change. I mean, this is the early afternoon, right? It started getting cooler and darker, and we could actually see darkness moving from the southwest of us, where the sky was noticeably darker that way. And then all the birds that were flying just settled down and went to sleep, and the whole area got really quiet. And then when it got to just 99% occlusion, and then the whole sky got dark, that's when you could really feel it. It was like a storm had just moved in, and it felt very, very uncanny. And then we had this, some good photos where you just see just the limb of the sun, like a fingernail. And at that point, you could imagine what it'd be like 1,000, 2,000 years ago to be, out in your fields if you're a peasant or, bopping around on horseback, and suddenly this darkness. And then it turned back and the sun gradually returned. And the birds woke up and, went back to flying around, and it was powerful. And
did the stars blink at you?
They did not. They did not this time. I'm still hoping for that. That's a little Three Body reference from Tony there,
I'm still disappointed with that show, to be honest. Still gets us a little bit upset. You know what I mean? I should have carried on reading that book. Do you know what I mean?
You absolutely should. Or watch the 10 Cent adaptation.
Yeah, I know. But you know what put us off that as well, actually, Brian, is when you said there's loads of them. You know what I mean? There's quite a few episodes.
That's 30.
There's so much at the moment. Do you know what I mean? It's like I'm feeding my brain left, right, and center, you know, like little short stories for coverage on this show, you know, like TV shows. And
yeah,
it's just like how much entertainment can I absorb in? You know,
it's a rough life.
You know what? Again, we're going back to like Asimov. It's just like I say, that a short story, and then I'm not sure if it was 1990. It was formed into a book. As I forget who, Silverberg. That's right, Silverberg took it on and made it. You know, had permission from Isaac Asimov to make it into a fully fledged novel. You know what I mean? So many years later, one short story that he probably wrote in a, you know, in his bedroom, 1941, and then it still had legs. Do you know what I mean? And still carried the day.
How is it? I haven't read the novel.
Read the novel. No. It's just, but I mean, it's Silverberg. So, and I heard a little just byline that Asimov was like, oh, he's, you know, Bob's done a good job. It was almost like, you know what I mean? That kind of, oh, he's the man. He's done a good job. So I think it got his blessing when it came out as well. And I think it went into the bestsellers. And, you know, it would, I suppose, if Silverberg was right.
It reminds me of in the Hugo winners anthologies when Asimov would introduce all the stories. And whenever he introduced a Harlan Ellison story, he would just tease Ellison. So there's one introduction where he's like, well, here's this Ellison story, and I don't like the title. I think this title's too long. So here, let me try introducing it. It's called Adrift Off the... It's called... No, let me just tell you about a great story called Nightfall.
Man, do you know what I mean? I was lucky enough, you know, in with Starship Sofa to kind of catch tail ends of folk, you know, because there's been so many kind of passing away over the, you know, in the natural kind of works of life there, people pass away, but there's been some great writers. You know, obviously Starship Sofa wasn't around when Asimov was kicking around, but some great, you know, I spoke to Robert Silverberg. I think he's still knocking around, mind. Yeah, he must be a good old age now there, but
yeah.
There was a quote, and I think I've mentioned this on Starship Sofa before with Robert Silverberg, where he can't even remember writing certain novels, so he'll walk into a shop. Oh, look at this. There's a new novel by Robert Silverberg. And then realizes it's him. You know what I mean? I just think that's wow. Lovely chap, to be honest. Very nice to kind of deal with.
Great.
Because we did a story, you know, years ago. And it was actually through Skyboat Media. Stefan Rudnicki narrated it for us. And I forget the actual name of it now. it's fantastic, bloody... fantastic narration by Stefan as well. But
nice.
Anyway, getting on to some tech stuff there. Well, actually not. Well, I suppose it is technical. It's scientists have uncovered evidence of microplastics that are I just think this is just such a sad state of affairs. You know, like these microplastics are getting everywhere and now contaminating, you know, archaeological digs.
Yeah.
It's just, well... What do you think of this, Brian? Is it too much to ask that it's like we're all doomed?
Well, we're definitely all microplastic. There's been some interesting debates for the past 10 years about what name to apply to our era in history. And one of the signs of humanity's power over the world has been microplastics. You know, we've managed just to infuse this throughout the world. Right now, there's also the sign of forever chemicals, you know, PFAS, and how we've managed to put that in everything, drinking water, all kinds of aspects of the natural world. So that, you know, if humanity were to disappear tomorrow completely, we would still have that layer throughout the world. You know, archaeologists a million years from now will be able to go back and look at it. Oh, there's the Tony C. Smith era.
Yes, it's multicolored.
Microplastics and PFAS built into it all. Yeah.
Is it too late then, Brian, do you think? You know what I mean? And I know, I mean, I will pick on like a certain novel that I've kind of recognized going down this route. But, you know, we seem to be... trying our best, but I don't know if it's like the horse has bolted, you know, in a certain term.
Well, I'd be curious. I mean, how you could actually get rid of this stuff? I mean, maybe some kind of tailored bacterium would be one way of doing it, but of course, that has all kinds of potential downsides. because the stuff is so small, and also it's so neutral. It's just hard to get rid of. But this is you know, one side effect of our great plastic era. You know, go back to The Graduate, right? And the famous line, "I have just one word for you, plastics." Well, that might be the word for our civilization. And I mean, I do a lot of work in climate change, and this is another aspect that, you know, it's possible that if we take climate change seriously, that we might start producing fewer plastics because they have a hefty carbon footprint by themselves. We haven't paused that right now. We're still, you know, throwing away eagerly, you know, producing, using, and tossing away plastics. That's why we have the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, for example. But this is the kind of thing that science fiction has been worried about since forever. I mean, you know, we have all the great novels from the 1960s and 70s about the environment, about environmental degradation. For me, John Brunner's The Sheep Look Up is one of the just great novels of absolute despair and terror in the face of this. We mentioned the three body problem. And one of the interesting things about that is the a plot device features Rachel Carson's great book, Silent Spring. You know, having that actually kicks off one of the major plots. I would think of J.G. Ballard, who began his career by writing, what, four, five novels where the world is destroyed by humanity. You know, we have a lot of science fiction which is thinking about this. And now, right then, 21st century, there's this subgenre called climate fiction, which, you know, tries to imagine the future of the Anthropocene. And some of it's science fiction. I think a lot of it is science fiction. People don't want to recognize it as such. But we have quite a few books that are along these lines. And The Sheep Look Up, for me, just has that.
Well,
please go ahead.
I didn't know, Brian. It was in my – well, I think it was. It was in my Audible account because I went on to Amazon thinking, all right, this is a wonder. This is the one, you know, he's British writer there. We'll get stuck in there. It was sitting in my Audible account, and honestly, I'm not joking, Brian, within five pages, when was it wrote? It was wrote probably pretty early on. I don't know if it's like the 60s or the 70s.
Yeah.
Might even be a touch later, but he, in the first five pages, because I listened to it again, he nails the state we are now. Do you know what I mean? It's just such a vision he had, you know, and what a story. I'm not saying like a grim story, but what a way to kind of look at the future's coming from his perspective. And here we are. You know, we're living his kind of worst, probably, you know, one of his worst nightmares. He'll put it into fiction. And here we are. It's just a remarkable book, to be honest. It was. And there's three in his set, isn't it? Because there's The Stars on Zanzibar. And I'm sure, is it Shockwave?
Yeah. Shockwave Rider, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, there's three great books where he just busts out. And each of these tackles a ginormous problem, you know, the environment or information technology or overpopulation. But they're also just really, really rich books. They're all social novels. You've got dozens of characters that span the range of society. You know, you've got political actors, you've got ordinary people, scientists, communication people. And he whips back and forth between the plots at top speed.
Yeah. Well, it's funny, you know, because even listening to audio, and I think sometimes, well, definitely for me, audio is like my main, you know, source of dragging it into myself. There was a few times where I had to like, where am I now? You know, and like go back like 20 seconds, 30 seconds, skip back.
Yeah.
Just to, you know, and I didn't realize when you just look at Brunner, how much he wrote. You know what I mean? There's like a staggering amount of fiction he's got there is tremendous. It's just, it's unbelievable. You know what I mean? You normally find these kind of writers just, they're either, I'm not saying, I don't know what the best word, you know, like Ted Chiang just can't write. You know what I mean? Like lots of fiction to save his life, where like Lisa Brunner or Asimov just can rattle them off. You know, again, Silverberg.
Silverberg, but, like a novel every 10 days or something, you know, just constantly churning them out. Or Phil Dick, right, who was writing a novel, you know, twice a year plus a steady stream of short stories.
Mm-hmm. Just, But what a book, yes. I'll put a link if anyone wants to go and read that or get it in Audible, a grand book.
I strongly recommend it.
I'm sure, didn't he? He passed away at a science fiction convention, I think.
I think that's right.
We covered him in a very early Starship so far. I think we covered him and he passed away. He wasn't that old, you know what I mean? I think he was in his 60s or something like that. But
Yeah. Great writer.
So there you go. That is the new podcast. Now, as well, as a little treat as well, because we've been talking about John Brummer and, you know, The Sheep Look Up, didn't Stefan Rudnicki get in touch with us and say, hey, Tone, we can give you 30 minutes of, you know, because he narrated the story. The story is fantastic. He narrated it. He's got, you know, he can give us the kind of go-ahead. So we are allowed to play 30 minutes of that. And I'll put links in the show notes if you want to kind of go over to Audible or Amazon where you can get a hold, or wherever you can get a hold of that. So at the end of the show, there is, you know, after the main fiction, there is the little bit of The Sheep Look Up by John Brummer. So truly, it would be an honour if you pop over in these show notes there now. There's links to kind of the Apple podcast or in Spotify, you know, or just on your podcast app. Just search for it and, you know, subscribe to it. That would be fantastic. If you could, 5-star review would be lovely. And if you wanted to kind of join, we're on Patreon, like you say, ad-free, so you don't listen to any adverts, and you get the extra shows as well. We're going to do, like, where each week we are doing an extra show. And we talked about, because Severance, for me, was just a remarkable episode, you know what I mean, season, episode. Mine, Fallout was fantastic as well, and we'll talk about that as well. But we talked about Vernor Vinge in the first one. So, you know, joining Patreon, we get them extra ones as well, but subscribe will be fantastic. So, main fiction, like I say, it is Edward M. Lena with his Nothing to Lose. I'll give you a little heads up about Edward. Edward M. Lena is the author of 18 science fiction novels and many shorter works. The final novel in his Interstellar Net trilogy won the inaugural Campus Canopus Award, honouring excellence in interstellar writing, while other stories have been nominated for the Locus, Prometheus and Hugo Awards. His latest book, which is 2023, is a novel, Life, Death on Mars. Like I say, this story first appeared in Galaxy's Edge, May 2017, and it's narrated by our very own Will Staggle. Will is a proud member of Starship Sova, recruiting narrators for the podcast Stellar Stories. Will works as a creative professional and occasional musician from his adopted home in Tucson, Arizona. So, the Starship Sova is very proud to present
Nothing to Lose by Edward M. Lerner, read to you by Will Stagel. The copter settled onto an unremarkable spot of land in an otherwise empty expanse of ocean, remote from flight corridors, shipping lanes, fishing grounds. No one lived here. No one could live here for any length of time, absent frequent deliveries of food, fresh water, and other essentials. But for the scrub-covered, undulating slope of a low-weathered, long-dormant volcano and the wisps of vapor rising from the bubbling mud pots, the island would have been as featureless as the surrounding seas, all just as Lawrence Crawford had envisioned it. With quivering hands, he removed his headset, the better to revel in the now. This moment had been very long in the coming, almost as long as his painful, lingering death. We're here, Darren Wright, pilot, bodyguard, and body servant, shouted redundantly over the whop, whop, whop of the spinning down rotor. He was a sturdy man, a handsome man, a hale and hearty man, a man's man. He was everything that Lawrence was not, and never could be. Not in his life. Ready for the tour, sir? Lawrence nodded. Even not wrung out by hours in the air, he wouldn't have had the strength to make himself heard over the rotor noise. I'll see to the folks in the steerage, then be right back for you. Wright unbuckled, then leaned against the cockpit to open Lawrence's door just a bit. Meanwhile, enjoy some fresh air. Again, Lawrence nodded. To the chatter and clatter of the medical team exiting the cargo bay and unloading their gear, he admired the island. His island. For better or for worse, in one way or another, his new home. And he should enjoy the fresh warm air while he could. He breathed in a rich melange of scents, identifying none of them. Not quite citrus, not quite pine, something perfumey, something. Something brushed against his face, tickled his arm. A gossamer thread, glinting in the sunlight, had blown in through the gaping door. Was anything attached to it? Frantically, head gyrating, he searched. There, on his lap, a spider. It was striped gray and brown, and a full 2 inches across. Was it venomous? By his 5-point safety harness, he couldn't even properly cringe. His reflexive shriek came out airy and faint, pathetic. His feebler efforts to brush the arachnid off his leg were more pathetic still. Allow me, sir. With casual ease, Wright flicked off the spider and unbuckled the safety harness. He helped Lawrence into a wheelchair, retrieved from somewhere in the back. For all the man's practice and skill, the transfer was exhausting. The medical team had the good sense enough to gawk, or more likely, they were too preoccupied with peering about, getting their bearings to gape at him. His construction teams had arrived and departed in the same secure manner. It defied Lawrence to understand how anyone withstood hours in that windowless confined space, that bit of metal tube behind him. He only managed, and then just barely, in the cockpit with its big, clear canopy. His fear of enclosed spaces trumped his fear of heights. With his hand quivering and joints aching, he engaged the joystick to roll out from under the copter's still swooshing rotor. The sun felt warm and strange on his bare arms. There was little he could do outside that he couldn't as easily and more safely accomplish inside, so he seldom ventured outdoors. He waited, eyes darting about for snakes and more spiders, clutching an EpiPen, while Wright draped camouflage netting over the aircraft. That anyone might be observing this island was doubtful, but after so much preparation, so near to the plan's fruition, Lawrence wasn't about to take any chances. None. Wright rejoined him. Are you certain, sir? I'm dead if I don't. The words came out in a hoarse whisper. What do I have to lose? Days? Weeks? I don't know, sir. The company of friends and family? Except Lawrence didn't have friends. Servants in large numbers, and a nursing staff. Acquaintances, to be sure. But friends? No. Unless that he had been taught young. The children his absentee parents had once brought into the house were perhaps the best playmates that money could rent for their awkward, socially and physically, and sickly son. But had any of them ever been a friend? Hardly. And family? Well, he had cousins, eager for their go at the family trust, only with the expectation that he'd be dead soon had they become attentive. It warmed what passed for Lawrence's heart that once he disappeared, those vultures would be made to wait, with luck and with decent lawyers, for years, before they could prove their trusteeship vacant and get any of themselves installed as his successor. And that they would find then, private islands and underground lairs not coming cheap, especially when acquired surreptitiously, far less remaining in the trust than the imagined wealth they so indecorously drooled over. If his grand plan ended up going south, well, he considered the mind's eye picture of their enraged faces to be the silver lining. Mixed metaphors be damned. But are you certain, sir? Wright nagged again. Don't worry. I've seen to it that you'll be taken care of. That's not what I asked, sir. Carry on, Darren. Yes, sir. Wright accompanied the wheelchair as it slowly motored from the irregularly shaped helipad along a narrow and winding path to the nearby cave entrance into which the others had already vanished. Even viewed up close, the unsealed asphalt path, swirled and splotched with green paint, mimicked the nearby ancient lava flow with its every crack colonized by opportunistic weeds. Within a year or two, whether crumpled, overgrown with real plants, the resemblance would yet be more realistic. Within a few more years, surely, tropical downpours would abrade and wash away most of the asphalt. Low-powered overhead fixtures lit the way down a curving tunnel, the path here a flat and safety-textured concrete surface. Cobwebs hung from walls and ceiling, shimmering in the light, weaving in the slow air currents, turning the short jaunt into the running of a gauntlet. Again and again, Lawrence swerved to evade dangling webs, and twice to run over some scurrying arachnid. Twice the accursed creatures eluded him. From the end of the passageway, where the sturdy steel door had been left ajar, issued bright light, murmurs of conversation, and the drone of electrical equipment. His servant scurried ahead to hold the door, and Lawrence rolled inside. Finally, he would see all that money, lots of it, years of planning, and an iron will had wrought. Nearest to the entrance, behind a glass wall, sat surgical prep and the OR. Everything about them was first-rate, despite the remote and subterranean location, but he had experienced too many such facilities to be particularly interested in these. While the medical team did final checkout of their equipment, scrubbed, consulted, and otherwise prepared, he rolled deeper into the tunnel toward the more novel apparatuses. The first such was the main status board, its many lamps glowing a steady green. Beyond that were thermoelectric generators, four redundant power plants, each without moving parts to wear out, each tapping the geothermal energy that was, beyond inaccessibility, obscurity, and freedom from any country's law, the primary attribute of this desert island. For as long as the magma chamber a few thousand feet below radiated its heat, this facility would never lack for power. Next came the Communications and Computing Center, into which satellite TV feeds endlessly streamed from camouflaged antennae on the island's surface. Yet more information wirelessly flowed, almost as anonymously, from carefully chosen servers on the darknet. Expert system software parsed the updates relayed by those darknet servers and whatever closed caption text accompanied science and news broadcasts. But would that software spot the hoped-for needle in some future haystack? A few keystrokes retrieved the files over which he had so struggled. With a more specific diagnosis than multiple autoimmune disorder, choosing search terms would have been much easier. Lawrence scrolled through long lists of autoimmune symptoms and syndromes, then reviewed his other less ambiguous, if equally critical, keywords. He studied the various propositions in Boolean logic and ultimately found nothing to tweak. The penultimate cove held the magnetic refrigeration equipment, four redundant units, again without moving parts, and without refrigerant or coolant fluid of any kind to gradually escape and require replenishment. Such refrigeration was pricey and hideously inefficient, but this place had power, and he had money to spare. At the far end of the corridor, he arrived at the cooldown facility. Its centerpiece, a gleam between twin spotlights, was a silvery vat. It was so small. Logically, Lawrence told himself, just this once the confined space didn't. And illogically, it still weirded him out. Tough. Cheating death was not for sissies. Creepy or not, into that cryogenic deep freeze, very soon now, his head would go, for however long was necessary, and just his head. Nothing from his useless failing husk, but his brain should be preserved. Let Russian hackers do their worst, or jihadis, tree huggers, North Korean punks with nukes. No matter who went nuts, and someone surely would, how often power grids crashed as a result, this place would quietly and discreetly keep humming, and eventually all would be well. If ever the procedure got underway, that was. Lawrence spun around the wheelchair and retraced his route. The bustle and purposeful susurrations in the operating room made clear that the doctors were still not ready for him. He was a paycheck and a burden, welcome to stew in his own putrefying juices until they were ready to take him apart. Well, he was accustomed to being dismissed, accustomed to waiting, accustomed to boredom. With nothing to do, wearied by the flight and the fright, by the weight and his pathetically trivial exertions, he closed his eyes. Just for a few minutes, he promised himself. How old had he been? 4, maybe. Too young in any event to grasp the nuances of hide-and-go-seek. He would announce where he'd be hiding and that his reluctant, pimped-out playmates should see if they could find him. Somehow, they always did. That day, the nanny had again arranged for a group of his friends to come for a playdate. He remembered their whispering, their laughter that day. One of the older kids took Lawrence aside, told him how really to play the game, offered to find him the best hiding spot. The two of them went together into the sub-basement beneath the servant's wing. Back then, the disease progression had rendered him merely clumsy, not yet paraplegic, ending up outside a low storage cubby enclosed below a half flight of stairs. In here, the boy had said. Which boy? What was his name? The detail was gone, suppressed, But Lawrence well remembered the sprinkling of freckles across the bridge of the child's nose, the curly blonde hair, hints of mirth at the corners of lips and eyes. "This is a great hiding place." "You're sure? And you won't give me away?" "Oh, you can trust me on that." At first, Lawrence had been happy, even smug, in his cozy little hidey hole. No one found him. The sounds of the hunt receded until all he heard, only occasionally, was faint laughter. The air was still, stuffy. After a while, the dust prickling his nose and the whatever tickling and itching him all over were all he could notice. Boredom and discomfort won out over successful hiding. A spray of light under the door gave no hint of anyone nearby. Feeling he finally understood the game, feeling very clever, he thought to sneak away to some new spot. The door wouldn't open. He rattled the door. It was latched. He called to be let out. No one came. No one answered. He shouted for help, and still no one came. He lost it. He remembered standing, thrashing about, hands and arms and face coating themselves in a wispy, clinging something. The itching intensified. Screaming meant breathing, and with each ragged breath, he sucked more and more cobweb into his mouth, up his nose, down his throat. About then, as if set off by his thrashing, the biting began. Howling, kicking at the stubborn door, he first noticed things scuttling along the crack under the door, things with way too many legs. He understood then that they were crawling up his pant legs and down the neck hole of his t-shirt, dropping into his hair, scampering into his ears, clambering up his nose. He screamed and screamed and, with a shudder, he came alert. One of the male nurses, a gangly fellow with a horse face, was striding his way. Lawrence asked, "Are we ready?" "Yes, sir. Please come with me." Lawrence followed. A part of him marveled that this would be his last ride in the damned wheelchair, one way or the other. A second nurse, annoyingly solicitous, waited in the prep room. The two men together got Lawrence undressed into a surgical gown and onto a gurney. They started him on an IV and rolled him the short distance to the OR. The surgical team, masked and gowned, was gathered about. The anesthesiologist was focused on her apparatus. Everything looked exactly as it should. "Count backwards from 100, a masked figure directed. 100, Lawrence responded dutifully, exhilarated and terrified all at once. Was he engaged in, as every country's law would have it, simply an elaborate suicide? So be it. The final stages of bodily collapse held no charm. And surely to start the cryonic suspension somewhat before death would make him that much better preserved, better prepared for, in some unknowable future, his revival and cure. 99, 98, 97. Had he forgotten anything? Left any loose ends? It was too late if he... 96, 90... Of course, Dara knew the location of this island. The lawyer who had, through layers of shell companies, purchased this island for Lawrence, had also known. He had died not long afterwards. In a freak accident, it was said. And any of the medical team might accidentally or maliciously let slip what Lawrence had done, in the process putting his rapacious cousins on the hunt for his remains, the sooner to have him declared legally dead. 90, 22, 90, 23. Good thing the copter would never make it back to Los Angeles. Lawrence's final ill-formed notion, as numbers lost all meaning and the world went dark, was how pretty the fireball would be. He woke up. He woke up! He was alive! Lawrence found himself in an utterly ordinary recovery room. Beige walls, windowless, its door closed, hospital bed, its sides raised, some sort of monitor at bedside, softly beeping, an IV tube swooping from an overhead bag to vanish beneath his covers, antiseptic smell. The lone sour note was the gossamer billowing in the draft from a ceiling air vent. A spider-free future was too much to have hoped for. He was, what? Exhausted, but not in the usual way. Pain-free. For as long as he could remember, pain had been his constant companion. "How long?" he croaked. "Good, you're awake. A strange voice responded from a grill in the ceiling. But strange how? Accented? Yes, in some way he could not quite characterize. Androgynous? That too. But there was something more. Groggily, Lawrence tried to decide what made the disembodied voice so unusual. He settled at last on synthesized. A language translator? Yes, I'm awake, he rasped agreement. Truth be told, his voice sounded off too, and he inferred that he had been intubated. But awakened as what? He couldn't sit up or even raise an arm to admire his new embodiment. He didn't as much feel a body. Why can't I? Don't be alarmed, the strange voice directed. You have been given, well, you can think of it as a spinal block. Which would explain the absence of both sensation and motor control. But spinal blocks worked only below the injection site. Can't even turn my head. Spinal block is not an exact analogy, the voice soothed. Let us say medical practice is different than in your day. Bringing matters full circle to Lawrence's earlier question. How long? Quite a while. How long? We can't say exactly. How odd. Almost as odd as that neither doctor nor nurse had come to check on him. One puzzle at a time, Lawrence told himself. Of course you can. What's today's date? It is complicated, the strange voice answered. Anyway, you should rest. We will talk more afterward. No, Lawrence said. I've slept long enough. They must have remotely released something into his IV, because once more the world went dark. His eyes flew open. At his first awakening, Lawrence had been both exhilarated and groggy, sedated in one manner or another from that sort of spinal block. However he was being sedated, that treatment ongoing because he had yet to sense his body, the wooziness at least, had begun to ebb. How long? That had been his first question. With a clearer head, he knew another question was more important. What he most wanted to know was, awakened as what? There at the end. Except it hadn't been the end. He had hoped and expected to be reborn into a new and improved version of his body, a healed version. A good third of the parameters he'd specified had involved progress in genetic remedies for autoimmune diseases. Another large set had involved the proven capability, legal or otherwise, and hence the involvement with the Darknet, for human cloning. Implanting of his brain into his regrown body could explain his immobilization. Old brain and new nervous system would surely need time and physical therapy to integrate. And yet, there had always been other scenarios. He might be a mind uploaded into a computer, the recovery room merely a digital simulation of expected surroundings until he could be reoriented to a different sort of reality. The sights and sounds and smells were so vivid that if he were an upload, he couldn't wait to explore every futuristic virtuality he had to offer. The sights and sounds and smells were so vivid that if he were an upload, he couldn't wait to explore everything futuristic virtualities had to offer. And there were two possibilities even further out there. His mind, read out from his brain, might have been imprinted onto the blank brain of a clone body. Or his mind might have been imprinted onto the brain of a body, not his own clone. If that last, well, he felt no nostalgia for or allegiance to the flawed vessel into which he'd been born. Healthy clone of his old self? An upload into virtual reality? A mind transplant? He'd happily be any of those. The lurking computers on his island would have summoned the outside world had they gleaned proof of mature technology for any of those treatments. Good, you're awake again. The ceiling speaker announced in its peculiar synthesized voice. Your vitals continue to improve. I'd like to see myself, not to mention get the feel of this body. Although his throat felt better, his voice remained weak. Shallow, as if he were breathing only from his neck, not his diaphragm. I am sure that you would. For now, it is essential that you remain immobilized. Well, how about you drop by? It would be nice to see a friendly face. The voice hesitated. Soon. Because some vestige of him was newly conjoined with the biological body and so susceptible to infection? Could be. But if so, wouldn't he have been in more sterile surroundings? Considering the question, he heard the soft pat of people rushing past his room. They passed the closed door in silence. About how long has it been? Since your head was preserved in that remote location, we don't know. I'll do the math. What year is this? The voice again hesitated. The calendar has changed from what you knew. And you have no knowledge of when, by the former reckoning, the calendar changed? No. How is that even possible, barring a complete collapse of civilization? And even then, wouldn't there have been libraries or archives left behind? You have advanced technology, obviously, or I'd still only be a frozen head. So surely you have carbon dating. Unseen, more people scurried past, revealed by the shadows of legs cast beneath the door. Lawrence called out, "Come in, please! Someone!" But they continued on their way without responding. "We have carbon dating," the voice answered. "The method cannot be used back to the prior era." There were few enough activities a body busily destroying itself could manage, but reading was among them. Lawrence was no scientist, knew a little about a lot of subjects, carbon dating among them. Living organisms absorbed carbon, whether from carbon dioxide, as did plants, or from food, as did animals. A small fraction of that carbon was the naturally occurring radioactive isotope carbon-14, which decayed into nitrogen-14 in, well, you can remember exactly how long. Half-life somewhere on the order of 5,000 years. Stop breathing, plant or animal or frozen head ceased to take in any new carbon. As the carbon-14 earlier absorbance slowly decayed, the ratio of carbon-14 to the more common and stable carbon-12 predictably declined. Archaeologists routinely use the technique to date organic remains many millennia old. Lawrence said hesitantly, "Then I was frozen so long there was no appreciable carbon-14 remaining in me, or in the organic objects within my underground facility?" "Correct." Lawrence shivered. The spinal block, or whatever they had given him, didn't stop that, although it did render the autonomous motion somehow unfamiliar. "As you can imagine, after so long, after so much transpired in the world, we are eager to learn from you about our predecessors."
"Then how, I mean, why did, what?"
His voice trailed off, struggling to formulate a coherent thought.
"Computers were set to monitor for evidence I could be revived and cured, if as much time has passed as you say."
He had expected to be hidden away, waiting for technologies to advance, for 20 or 30 years. 50 years tops. But long enough for carbon dating to fail? He'd been frozen for ages. Tens of thousands of years at a minimum. Long before that, broadcast formats and networking protocols would have evolved beyond recognition, even without the evident collapse of civilization. And the money he'd squirreled away at a half dozen offshore numbered accounts, sheltered by as many tax havens, doubtlessly is completely gone, as if it had never existed. So be it. Starting over was not the worst possible outcome from his gamble. Lawrence tried again to make sense of the situation.
"Help wasn't summoned to my island by a radio broadcast. True?"
"True. Visitors of a sort, you might call them vacationers, quite by accident found the cave with your remains. It has been a long-term effort since, with this day much anticipated, not only to find a way to revive you, but to learn to communicate with you when we succeeded. To reconstruct a dead language from unknowably ancient ruins and relics," Lawrence interpreted. "To teach a computer to translate to and from English." He asked,
"What happened to the civilization I knew that is?"
"It ended, and we don't know why. What we have found is, well, inconclusive. And in the greater scheme of things, what did it matter?
Are you a doctor? Did you have a hand in my treatment?"
"In a manner of speaking, in your terms, I am a psychologist."
"With all due respect," Lawrence said, "I don't need a psychologist. I need to know what's happened to me, the nature of my treatment going forward, and when I'll be released from the hospital."
"The next time you're awake," the voice promised.
"I'm awake now," Lawrence began.
Only once more to be dropped into the arms of that bastard, Morpheus. He woke. Something had changed from past awakenings, and he struggled to put his finger on it. The room looked the same. He still couldn't move, but he was tingling. It was an odd sensation, but it gave hope that the spinal block was wearing off. "Good day," the familiar voice said. "The doctor is with me." "Good day," Lawrence heard again. The synthesizer rendered the second voice with a different timbre. It occurred to Lawrence that the psychologist had never introduced himself. With a second disembodied voice added to the mix, names seemed helpful. Or these future folks could come into the damned room already. "My name is Lawrence, and you are?" "We do not use personal labels in the manner we understand your culture did. To address us individually, You might say psychologist or doctor. As if an afterthought, that newer, more mellow voice added, I am the doctor. Thank you, doctor, Lauren said. Thank you for everything you have done. I've been wanting to speak with you. Naturally, psychologist said. Don't interrupt. Lawrence kept the thought to himself. As helpless as a bug pinned to a mounting board, he did not dare to antagonize anyone. I understand that the people of this, well, to me, the far future, are eager to learn about my era. I am as keen to experience yours. But first, as you can imagine, I'm eager to complete my recovery, and am overcome with curiosity about the nature of my revival. Well, yes, psychologist said, it is. Complicated? Lawrence interrupted. I'm certain it is. You brought me back from no more than a head. But what am I? How have I been brought back? Well, doctor began hesitantly, our culture and yours took different approaches to several sciences. In medicine, we have had significant success compared to what we understood about your time in suppressing the immune response to transplants. I see, Lawrence said, wondering if he did. Rejection involved foreign tissue, so he wasn't a mind, mere data, transferred into a new brain or uploaded into a digital simulation. And his own clone wouldn't reject a transplant of his head or brain. You've transplanted my head onto someone else's body. We did, doctor confirmed. Lawrence, based upon way too much exposure to the medical profession, found that hesitation ominous. One very large shoe remained to drop. Amputees often complained of phantom limb pain. As his sedation wore off, would he have phantom body pain? Was the tingling its first sign? First things first, Lawrence decided. And the donor, what happened to him? We want you to understand, psychologist said, that we've done everything in our power to facilitate your transition into our society, truly. The unsolicited reassurance only worried Lawrence more. Or was it the tingles? Ever since he had last awakened, the sensations had been getting more intense. From intermittent itching and faint prickles, he'd progressed to feeling all over hairy. The donor, doctor began, that unfortunate individual had an accident, suffering head injury with fatal brain trauma. Absent cloning technology, of course an accident victim was the body donor. Between the blatant circumlocutions, avoiding any characterization of the donor, whether of gender or age or anything, and the spreading, intensifying itch Lawrence had no way to scratch, he almost snapped. He had defeated a horrible, debilitating illness. He had survived the fall of civilization, damn it. Whatever psychologist was loath to divulge, he could take it. Please, just tell me. Very well, psychologist said, but it will be easier to show you. By some futuristic wizardry, the walls turned reflective. Lawrence saw himself in the bed. Only his head, raised on a pillow, was outside the covers. He saw no scar where his neck met his new body, but then again, couldn't really see his neck. The spinal block has been released, doctor said. You should be able to move momentarily. Indeed, something had changed. The itchy, hairy feeling further intensified. On his third attempt, Lawrence wriggled partway out from beneath the covers. Only what emerged, thick with wire-like bristles, wasn't an arm. Gaping, not exactly in control of the hideous limb, his flailing dislodged the thin blanket to reveal his human head grafted onto a shiny, segmented carapace. As the recovery room door swung open, emitting two man-tall hairy spiders, Lawrence began to scream.
And there you go, Edward. Whoa, it's honestly, it is an honor to have you on the show. Thank you so much. And Will, I'm giving you a big bear hug now there. Big thank you for doing this step. Just a lovely, lovely narration. Absolutely fantastic, to be honest. Brilliant. So like I mentioned, we have got now 30 minutes of The Sheep Look Up by John Brunner. And like I say, we covered him in years ago, do you know what I mean? And just a remarkable writer with so much to kind of discover now. And like, that's the whole, you know, talking about the sofa notes. That's what myself and Brian are kind of doing, you know what I mean? It's itching to talk to something, you know what I mean, about science fiction and the world today, the technology today. And again, it'd be lovely if you kind of popped over and subscribed to that show. And a big thank you to Stefan, Skyboat Media, for allowing us to kind of play this story. So, Starship Sova is very proud to present The Sheep Look Up by John Brunner, narrated by Stefan Rudnicki.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
December. Prospectus. The day shall dawn when never child but may go forth upon the sward secure to play. No cruel wolves shall trespass in their nooks. Their lore of lions shall come from picture books. No aging tree a falling branch shall shed to strike an unsuspecting infant's head. From forests shall be tidy copses born, and every desert shall become a lawn. Lisping their stories with competing zest, one shall declare, "I come from out the west, where grandpa toiled the fearful sea to take, and pen it tamely to a harmless lake." Another shall reply, "My home's the east, where mama says dwelt once a savage beast, whose fangs he oft would bear in horrid rage. Indeed, I've seen one, safely in a cage." Likewise, the north, where once was only snow, the rule of halls and cottages shall know. The lovely music of a baby's laugh, the road, the railway, and the telegraph. And eke the south. The oceans round the pole shall be domestic. What a noble goal! Such dreams unfailingly the brain inspire. And to exploring, Englishmen do fire. Christmas in the New Rome, 1862. Carnage. Hunted? By wild animals? In broad daylight on the Santa Monica Freeway? Mad, mad. It was the archetype of nightmare. Trapped, incapable of moving, with monstrous, menacing beasts edging closer. Backed up for better than a mile, three lanes trying to cram into an exit meant for two. Reeking and stalking and roaring. For the time being, though, he was more afraid of running than of staying where he was. Bright fangs repeating the gray gleam of the clouds. A cougar. Claws innocent of any sheath. A jaguar. Winding up to strike. A cobra. Hovering. A falcon. Hungry. A barracuda. However, when his nerve finally broke and he tried running, it wasn't any of these that got him, but a stingray. Signs of the times. This beach not safe for swimming. Not drinking water. Unfit for human consumption. Now wash your hands. Penalty for noncompliance, $50. Filter mask dispenser. Use product once only, maximum 1 hour. Oxygen, 25 cents. Not in our stars. The radio said, "You deserve security. Stronghold style." Blocking access to the company parking lot on the left of the street was a bus. Huge, German, articulated, electric, discharging passengers. Waiting impatiently for it to move on, Philip Mason pricked up his ears. A commercial for a rival corporation? The unctuous voice went on, backed by non-music from cellos and violas. "You deserve to sleep undisturbed. To go on vacations as long as you can afford, free from worry about the home you've left behind. Don't they say a man's home is his castle, and shouldn't that be true for you?" No, not insurance. Some dirty property developer. What the hell was this bus stopped here for, anyhow? It belonged to the city of Los Angeles, okay, right color, name painted on the side. But in place of a destination board, it just had a stock sign on hire, and he couldn't see details of its occupants through its grimy windows. But that was hardly surprising, since his own windshield was grimy, too. He had been going to hit the horn. Instead, he hit the wash-and-wipe stud, and a moment later was glad of the choice he'd made. Now he could discern half a dozen dull-faced kids, 3 black, 2 yellow, 1 white, and the head of a crutch. Oh. The speech from the radio continued. "What we've done for you is build that castle. Nightly, armed men stand guard at all our gates, the only points of access through our spike-topped walls. Stronghold estates employ the best trained staff. Our watchmen are drawn from the police. Our sharpshooters are all ex-Marines, of whom there's no shortage since they kicked us out of Asia." Ah, the bus signaling a move. Easing forward past its tail, and noting from the corner of his eye a placard in its rear window which identified the hiring organization as Earth Community Chest, Inc., he flashed his lights at the car next behind, asking permission to cut in front. It was granted. He accelerated, and an instant later had to jam the brakes on again. A cripple was crossing the entrance to the lot, an Asiatic boy in his early teens, most likely Vietnamese, one leg shrunk and doubled up under the hip, his arms widespread to help him keep his balance on a sort of open aluminum cage with numerous straps. Harold, thank God, isn't that bad. All the armed gate guards, black, a prickling of sweat at the idea he might have run the boy down under the muzzles of their guns. Yellow means honorary black. It is sweet to have companions in adversity. And thinking of companions, oh, shut up. "There's never any need to fear for your children," mused the radio. "Daily armored buses collect them at your door, take them to the school of your choice. Never for a second are they out of sight of responsible, affectionate adults." The boy completed his hurtling journey to where the sidewalk resumed, and Philip was finally able to ease his car forward. A guard recognized the company sticker on his windshield and hit the lift for the red and white pole that closed the lot. Sweating worse than ever, because he was horribly late, and even though that wasn't his fault, he was perfused with abstract guilt which made him feel vaguely that everything today was his fault. From the Baltimore bombings to the communist takeover in Bali, he stared around. Oh, shit. Packed solid. There wasn't one gap he could squeeze into without guidance, unless he wasted more precious time in sawing back and forth with inches to spare. "They will play in air-conditioned recreation halls," the radio promised, "and whatever medical attention they may need is on hand 24 hours per day at low, low contract rates. All right for someone earning $100,000 a year. For most of us, even contract rates are crippling. I should know. Aren't any of those guards going to help me park?" Hell no, all going back to their posts. Furious, he wound down his window and made violent beckoning gestures. At once the air made him cough, and his eyes started to water. He simply wasn't used to these conditions. "And now a police flash," said the radio. Maskless, his expression revealing a trace of, what, surprise, contempt? Something, anyway, which was a comment on this Charlie who couldn't even breathe straight air without choking. The nearest guard moved toward him, sighing. "Rumors that the sun is out of Santa Ynez are without foundation," the radio said. "I'll repeat that." And did, barely audible against the drone of an aircraft invisible over cloud. Philip piled out, clawing a $5 bill from his pocket. "Take care of this thing for me, will you? I'm Mason,
Denver area manager. I'm late for a conference with Mr. Chalmers. He got that much said before he doubled over in another fit of coughing. The acrid air ate at the back of his throat. He could imagine the tissues becoming horny, dense, impermeable. If this job's likely to involve me in frequent trips to L.A., I'm going to have to buy a filter mask. And the hell with looking sissy. So on the way here, it isn't only girls who wear them anymore. The radio mumbled on about extreme congestion affecting all roads northbound. Yeah, the guard said, taking the bill and rolling it neatly one-handed into a cylinder like a joint. Go right on in. They've been expecting you. He pointed across the lot to where an illuminated sign above a revolving door wished the world a Merry Christmas from Angel City Interstate Mutual. Been expecting? I sure hope that doesn't mean they gave up and went ahead without me. Feet planted on signs of Libra, Scorpio, Sagittarius, as the revolving door hush-hushed. It turned stiffly. The airtight seals around it must recently have been renewed. Beyond, a cool marble-walled foyer, also ornamented with zodiacal emblems. Angel City's publicity was geared to the idea of escaping the destiny you'd been born to, and both those who took astrology seriously and those who were skeptical appreciated the semi-poetical quality of the ad copy which resulted. Here the air was not only purified, but delicately perfumed. Waiting on a bench and looking bored, a very pretty light brown girl in a tight green dress, demurely sleeved, the skirt touching the neat Cuban, Miranda heels of her black shoes, but slit to the waist in front. Moreover, she was wearing pubic panties with a tuft of fur at the crotch to suggest hair. Last night, in Vegas? Christ, I must have been out of my mind, knowing I had to sleep well, be in top form for today. But it didn't feel that way at the time. Just, oh God, I wish I knew. Bravado? Craving for variety? Denny, I swear I love you. I'm not going to throw my precious job away. Won't even look at this girl. Chalmers' floor is 3, isn't it? Where's the directory? Oh, behind those filter mask dispensers. Yet intermixed, pride in working for this firm whose progressive image was carried clear through to ensuring that its secretaries wore the trendiest of clothes. That dress wasn't Orlon or nylon either. It was wool. However, it was impossible not to look. She rose and greeted him with a broad smile. "You're Philip Mason," her voice a trifle hoarse. Comforting to know that other people were affected by the air in L.A. If only the huskiness didn't lend such a sexy quality. "We met last time you were here, though probably you wouldn't remember. I'm Bill Chalmers' aide, Felice." "Yes, I do remember you." The cough conquered, though a faint, itchy sensation remained on his eyelids. The statement wasn't mere politeness, either. He did now recall her. But his last visit had been in summer, and she'd been wearing a short dress and a different hairstyle. "Is there somewhere I could wash up?" he added, displaying his palms to prove he meant wash. They were almost slimy with the airborne nastiness that had eluded the precipitator on his car. It wasn't designed to cope with California.
"Surely. Just along the hallway to the right. I'll wait for you."
The men's room bore the sign of Aquarius, as the women's did the sign of Virgo. Once, when he first joined the company, he'd raised a laugh clear around a group of his colleagues by suggesting that in the interests of true equality, there should be only one door marked Gemini. Today he wasn't in a joking mood. Under the locked door, one of the cubicles, feet. Wary because of the incidents of men's room muggings these days, he relieved himself with one eye fixed on that door. A faint sucking sound reached his ears, then a chinking. Christ, a syringe being filled. Not an addict with an expensive habit who sneaked in there for privacy? Should I get out my gas gun? Now, that way lay paranoia. The shoes were elegantly shined, hardly those of an addict who neglected his appearance. Besides, it was over 2 years since he'd last been mugged. Things were improving. He moved toward the line of wash basins, though he took care to select one whose mirror reflected the occupied cubicle. Not wanting to leave greasy marks on the light fabric of his pants, he felt cautiously in his pocket for a coin to drop in the water dispenser. Damnation, the dirty thing had been altered since his last visit. He had nickels and quarters, but the sign said only dimes. Wasn't there even one free one? No. He was on the point of going back to ask Felice for change when the cubicle door swung open. A dark-clad man emerged, shrugging back into a jacket whose right-hand side pocket hung heavy. His features struck a vague chord of memory. Philip relaxed, neither an addict nor a stranger. Just a diabetic, maybe, or a hepatic. Looking well on it, either way, from his plump cheeks and ruddy complexion. But who?
Ah, you must be here for this conference of Chalmers's.
Striding forward, the not stranger made to extend his hand, then canceled the gesture with a chuckle.
Sorry. I better wash up before shaking with you. Halkin, out of San Diego, by the way.
Tactful with it, too. I'm Mason, out of Denver. You don't have a spare dime, do you?
Sure. Be my guest.
Thank you, Philip muttered, and carefully stoppered the drain hole before letting the water run. He had no idea how much a dime bought you, but if it was the same amount that it cost a nickel a year and a half ago, it was barely enough to soap and rinse with. He was 32, yet today he felt like a gangling teenager, insecure, confused. His skin itched as though it were dusty. The mirror told him it didn't show, and his swept-back brown hair was still tidy, so that was all right. But Halkin was wearing practical clothes, almost black, whereas he himself had put on his newest and smartest gear, by Colorado standards, much influenced, of course, by the annual influx of the winter sports jet set. And it was pale blue because Denise said it matched his eyes, and while it could never be crumpled, it was already showing grime at collar and cuffs. Memo to self, next time I come to L.A. The water was terrible, not worth the dime. The soap, at least the company kept cakes of it on the basins, instead of demanding another dime for an impregnated tissue, barely lathered between his palms. When he rinsed his face, a trickle ran into his mouth, and he tasted sea salt and chlorine.
You got held up like me, I guess, Halkin said, turning to dry his hands in the hot air blower.
That was free.
What was it, those filthy trainites occupying Wilshire?
Washing his face had been a mistake. There were no towels, paper or otherwise. Philip hadn't thought to check beforehand. There's this big thing about cellulose fibers in the water of the Pacific. I read about it and failed to make the connection. His sense of awkward teenageness worse than ever. He had to twist his head into the stream of warm air, meantime wondering, what do they do for toilet paper? Round pebbles? Muslim style? Keep up the facade at all costs.
No, my delay was on the Santa Monica Freeway. Oh, yes. I heard traffic was very heavy today. Some rumor about the sun coming out?
It wasn't that. Repressing the ridiculous impulse to make sure no one black was in earshot, such as Felice or the guards around the parking lot, crazy Spade jumped out of his car in the middle of a jam and tried to run across the other half of the road.
You don't say. Stoned, was he?
I guess he must have been. Oh, thanks. Halkin courteously holding the door. Naturally, the cars that were still moving in the fast lanes had a brake and swerve and bang. Must have been 40 of them bumped each other. Missed him by a miracle, not that it did him any good. The traffic coming away from the city was doing 50-60 at that point, and when he got across the divide, he fell in front of a sports car. Good Lord. This had brought them level with Felice, who was keeping an elevator for them, so they ushered her inside, and Halkin hovered his hand over the floor selection buttons.
Three, isn't it?
No, we're not in Bill's office. We're in the conference room on the 7th.
Was your car damaged?
Halkin went on. No, luckily mine wasn't included in the shunt, but we had to sit there for more than half an hour before they got the road clear. You said you were held up by trainites?
Yes, on Wilshire.
Halkins' professional smile gave way to a scowl.
Lousy Dodgers, most of them, I bet. If I'd known I was sweating out my time for their sake. You did yours, of course.
Yes, of course, in Manila.
My stint was in Nam in Laos.
The car was slowing, and they all glanced at the lighted numbers. But this wasn't 7, it was 5. The doors parted to reveal a woman with a spotty face who said under her breath, "Ah, shit," and stepped into the car anyway.
"I'll ride up with you and down again," she added more loudly. "You could wait until doomsday in this filthy building."
The windows of the conference room were bright yellow-gray. The proceedings had started without waiting for the last two arrivals. Philip was thankful that he wasn't entering alone. 8 or 9 men were present in comfortable chairs with foldaway flaps bearing books, notepads, personal recorders. Facing them across a table shaped like an undernourished boomerang William Chalmers, vice president in charge of interstate operations, a black-haired man in his late 40s who had developed too much of a paunch to get away with the fashionable figure-hugging gear he was wearing. Standing, interrupted by the intrusion, Thomas Gray, the company's senior actuary, a bald, lean man of 50, with such thick spectacles one could imagine their weight accounting for the habitual forward stoop of his shoulders. He looked put out, scratching absently under his left arm. He accorded no more than a curt nod by way of greeting. Chalmers, however, welcomed the latecomers cordially enough, brushed aside their apologies, waved them to the remaining vacant places, right in the front row, of course. The wall clock showed 2 minutes of 11 instead of the scheduled 10:30. Trying to ignore it, Philip picked up a folder of papers from his assigned chair and distributed mechanical smiles to those of his colleagues with whom he could claim casual acquaintance. Casual. Don't think about Laura. Denny, I love you. I love Josie, I love Harold, I love my family. But if only you hadn't insisted on my... Oh, shut up! Talk about mountains out of molehills. But his situation was precarious, after all. Notoriously, he was by nearly 7 years the youngest of Angel City's area managers. L.A., Bay, SoCal, Oregon, Utah, Arizona, NM, Texas, Colorado. Texas due for subdivision next year, the grapevine said. But as yet it hadn't happened. That meant that his footsteps were being hounded by hordes of skilled, degree-equipped unemployed. He had 6 salesmen with PhDs, running to stay in the same place. If we can continue, Gray said. Philip composed himself. The first time he had met the actuary, he had assumed him to be a dry extension of his computers, lost in a world where only numbers possessed reality. Since then, however, he had learned that it had been Gray who hit on the notion of adopting astrological symbolism for the firm's promotional material, and thereby endowed Angel City with its unique status as the only major insurance company whose business among clients under 30 was expanding as fast as the proportion of the population they represented. Anyone with that much insight was worth listening to. Thank you. I was just explaining why you've come. Eyes rolling back to the limits of their sockets, mouth ajar, breath hissing in her throat. Useless denying it to myself. No woman ever made me feel more like a man. Philip touched the inside of his cheek with the tip of his tongue. She had slapped him backhanded and marched out of the motel cabin with blazing eyes because he had offered her money. There was a cut. It had bled for 5 minutes. It was next to his right upper canine, all his life the sharpest of his teeth. It's because, Gray continued, of the hike in life insurance premiums we're going to impose from January 1st. Of course, we've always predicated our quotations on the assumption that life expectancy in the United States would continue to rise, but during the past 3 years it has in fact started to go down. A roost for chickens. Sharp on 9, the trainites had scattered caltrops in the roadway and created a monumental snarl up 12 blocks by 7. The fuzz, as usual, was elsewhere. There were always plenty of sympathizers willing to cause a diversion. It was impossible to guess how many allies the movement had. At a rough guess, though, one could say that in New York City, Chicago, Detroit, L.A., or San Francisco, people were apt to cheer, while in the surrounding suburbs or the Midwest, people were apt to go fetch guns. In other words, they had least support in the areas which had voted for Prexy. Next, the stalled cars had their windows opaqued with a cheap commercial compound used for etching glass, and slogans were painted on their doors. Some were long. This vehicle is a danger to life and limb. Many were short. It stinks. But the commonest of all was the universally known catchphrase, "Stop, you're killing me." And in every case, the inscription was concluded with a rough egg shape above a saw tire, the simplified ideogrammatic version of the invariable trainite symbol, a skull and crossbones reduced to a circle above an X. Then, consulting printed data sheets, many of which were flapping along the gutter hours later in the wind of passing cars, they turned to the nearby store windows and obscured the goods on offer with similarly appropriate slogans. Unprejudiced, they found something apt for every single store. It wasn't too hard. Delighted, kids on the afternoon school shift joined in the job of keeping at bay angry drivers, store clerks, and other meddlers. Some of them weren't smart enough to get lost when the fuzz arrived, by helicopter after frantic radio messages, and made their first trip to juvenile hall. But what the hell? They were of an age to realize a conviction was a keen thing to have. Might stop you being drafted. Might save your life. Most of the drivers, however, had the sense to stay put, fuming behind their blank windshields as they calculated the cost of repairs and repainting. Practically all of them were armed, but not one was stupid enough to pull a gun. It had been tried during a train night demonstration in San Francisco last month. A girl had been shot dead. Others, anonymous in whole head masks and drab mock homespun clothing, had dragged the killer from his car and used the same violent acid they applied to glass to write "murderer" on his flesh. In any case, there was little future in rolling down a window to curse the demonstrators. Throats didn't last long in the raw air.
There you go, Stefan. Oh, man, honestly. When Stefan dropped us that email, I was just like, oh, so excited. Kind of, you know what I mean? We're playing like professional narrator there of Skyboat Media. Has just done, it's the voice, man. He's the voice of like our science fiction world. Stefan, just remarkable. Thank you so much. Like I say, we discuss Brunner and everything like that on Sofa Notes. Links in the description. I hope you enjoy it. I hope you listen to it there. Every week we will be coming on a Thursday. Yes, Starship Sofa comes out on a Wednesday. Then you've got time to kind of recuperate and again dip into kind of science fiction and technology. Until next week, just like to say good night from me.
Thank you for listening. I don't get out much. I've barely left the ground. I'm tuning into your transmissions. I'm moving, waiting to be found. And I'm building rockets. I'm pointing them to the moon. But the work is going slowly. To you anytime soon. Can you reach me? Is my signal getting through? Turn on your radio. I wanna talk to you. This signal's going light speed. By the time I get my say, I might already be on to you and on my way. But you're so far from here, and at best I'm moving slow. So I'm waiting on your call at home with nowhere to go. Can you reach me? Is my signal getting through? Turn on your radio. I wanna talk to you. I wanna talk to you. Myself on a radio wave, I might get to you someday. If books were rocket ships, I'd need only the will to fly. I'm still building word by word, and I'll get out there by and by. I'll get out there by and by. I'll get out there. I'll get out there by and by. I'll get out there by and by. I'll get out there.
Summer's just around the corner, so give your body the care it deserves with Osea's best-selling Andaria Algae Body Oil. Created by infusing Andaria seaweed in barrels of botanical oils, it leaves skin silky soft and glowing. Plus, it's clinically proven to improve elasticity and deeply moisturize without feeling greasy. It's safe, clean, vegan skincare. Get 10% off your first order at OseaMalibu.com with code GLOW, plus free shipping on orders over $60.